Good morning and welcome to Cool Science Radio. It's science and technology that's interesting and entertaining. I'm Lynn Ware Peake, here with John Wells. Today in the program, the biggest natural disaster in U.S. history and how that March day back in 1980 impacted the lives of those who lived and now the story of those who died. Stay with us for the untold story of Mount St. Helens.
Good morning, Lynn. And then it's a story of what the digital age has done to our culture and our economy. Our guest, Douglas Rushkoff, says in his book, Throwing Rocks at the Google Bus, that it's time to optimize our economy for the human beings it's supposed to be serving. Stay with us for this interesting conversation. This is Cool Science Radio. We'll be right back.
Miller Orthodontics supports KPCW and their involvement with area youth and teens. Speaking of youth, did you know Invisalign has a specific type of aligner just for teens? Over 3/4 of our Invisalign patients are 19 or younger. More information about Invisalign Teen is available at m2ortho.com.
The Spur and Grill is proud to support KPCW, located down the alley at 352 Main Street. The Spur is open every evening with dinner, drinks, and live music. The Spur Bar and Grill.com includes music schedules, menus, and contact information.
Welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm Lynn Ware Peake here with John Wells. Just got a call from someone that is stuck on Highway 248 saying it is a big mess out there. So avoid 248 if you can at all. Drive around the other way. Well, the largest natural disaster in U.S. history, was it Hurricane Katrina? The great San Francisco earthquake? No. It was a sunny day in 1980 in the southwestern portion of Washington state between Seattle and Portland. The eruption of Mount St. Helens. Our guest Steve Olson tells the untold story of the volcano and about the 57 lives that were lost, some up to 13 miles away from Mount St. Helens. Olson says the eruption of the volcano revealed how the past is constantly present in the lives of us all. He tells the story in his new book called Eruption. Steve Olson, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Thanks very much. Happy to be here.
Well, your book is so great. It reads like a mystery novel, and I congratulate you on that. It's really, you're engaged from the get-go, and it's all about the buildup, telling the stories of these lives of the people that were lost. But first you start off kind of setting the stage by taking us back to 1980. Where were we as a country, and then where were we in Washington at that point? Starbucks.
Well, it was an interesting time in United States history. That spring of 1980, the presidential campaign was just getting underway. In some ways, that time has a lot of parallels to the time we're living through right now. There was an unpopular president, Jimmy Carter, being contested by Ronald Reagan. And the United States was beginning to undergo large transformations that are still playing themselves out today. Here in the Northwest, for instance, this state, when I was growing up in the 1960s and 1970s, was based largely on extractive industries. So that was logging, to some extent fishing. Boeing and Weyerhaeuser were the two major employees. In 1980, that all started to change. Bill Gates moved his company back here from Albuquerque, and today it's a very different place than it was in 1980. And some of those same things have happened all over the country.
That's right. So the extractive resource or extractive industries are an important part of this story, logging in particular. But before we go there, tell us about why you started off with this in the story. I mean, how does this relate to Mount St. Helens? Were we bored? Were we distracted? Did we need a story?
I was amazed as I started researching this story. A lot had been written about Mount St. Helens, and yet as I started looking into the reasons why these 57 people were killed by the eruption, all of a sudden the story started connecting with all kinds of other aspects of the state, of politics, of the science of volcanology at the time. I just discovered that I could tell this much broader story by looking at the tragedies of these 57 people, it really struck me as odd that they were too close to this volcanic eruption. Yes, the eruption was much larger than geologists expected, but if you look, for instance, at Pompeii, it was 6 miles away from Vesuvius and was destroyed in just a few hours in AD 79 when Vesuvius erupted. Some of the victims of Mount St. Helens were much closer than that.
Yeah, exactly. You know, I was curious, I really enjoyed your book as well. Your book is 240 pages long, and it took you 140 pages before you actually started talking about the eruption. And I was fascinated. I was just fascinated with the story of Weyerhaeuser and in talking about the life of a logger. I always knew that a logger's job was very dangerous, but you described in some detail how dangerous it can be, and the miles and miles of river that could be clogged up with all these trees, and these guys get on there with these poking sticks. I mean, it's just a dangerous life.
It is true that in the first part of this book, I have sections on the history of the Weyerhaeuser family and the Weyerhaeuser Company. I talk about the National Forest. I talk about the building of the Transcontinental Railways. And readers, I mean, I found those stories fascinating. I'm glad you liked them, too. But readers may be wondering what all this is doing in a book about a volcanic eruption. You know, the one thing I can say is be patient. All will be revealed at the end, because it does come together and make sense as to how all of these things play out in just the few minutes right after the mountain erupted on May 18th, 1980. That's the surprising thing that I found as I started doing the research on this book.
And Lynn and I are surprisingly patient. We met in the green room before the conversation, and we were both talking about a logger's life and the Weyerhaeuser family and everything else. So, yeah, the whole thing did come together. I'm fascinated by something. You know, we watch TV and these movies, and in these action movies, stuff is blowing up all the time. And when it blows up, it always blows up really high into the sky. In this case, you know, maybe we're all sort of indoctrinated that that's how explosions occur. In this case, there was a lateral blast, and that did all this tremendous damage. I mean, there was this blast, lateral blast. There was the melting of snow and the mud flows. There was the ash. There were a lot of different pieces involved. But how unusual is a lateral blast? And do you think that the scientist could have done a better job in predicting that that was what was going on in the months leading up to the explosion?
It is the case that in 1980, the geologists were aware that lateral blasts can occur. And in studying Mount St. Helens in the years right before that, they had noted that lateral blasts had occurred on the mountain. In the year 1980, they weren't aware of how often lateral blasts can occur. It turns out that it's a fairly common behavior for volcanoes. They also weren't aware that lateral blasts could be as large as they were. That was one of many lessons that emerged from Mount St. Helens. In issuing the warnings, they probably did not do enough. With the conclusion I draw in the book is that they probably didn't do enough to emphasize the worst things that could happen. They sort of arrived at a consensus view of what the volcano was going to do, and what happened is sort of a worst case event. And people were unaware, especially the people around the mountain, were unaware that anything like that was possible. That was probably an oversight and something that geologists have worked hard to rectify since 1980.
So you talk about worst case scenario. That's indeed what happened. But even it seemed to me, I don't know, talk, Steve, if you would, a little bit about the lead up. You know, for example, at the University of Washington, they're looking at these seismic events occurring, you know, days, weeks before the blast. And they're saying, oh, yeah, maybe that's going to be, you know, they talked about another volcano along the 700-mile fault. You know, talk about what mistakes were made, or what exactly did they know and what didn't they know?
It is the case that when you go there today, and you go to the volcano, I don't know if you've ever been there, but it's just an amazing place. I'm always telling people that they should go. Even many people in Washington State haven't been there.
Right.
The extent of the devastation is just astonishing as you're approaching the volcano and see, even 36 years later, what the landscape looks like. And then when you go to the places where people were standing at the time and take a look at some of the pictures of, for instance, the deformation that was occurring on the volcano, it's just astonishing that anyone could have been in those locations and thought that they were safe. given observations of other volcanoes. And, you know, this is where some of the economic factors, the historical factors, the political factors come into play, because the danger zones that were established for the volcano at their closest were only 3 miles away from the peak. It was quite obvious that the danger zones weren't large enough, even given the kinds of events that geologists were talking about at the time.
So you talk about George Weyerhaeuser, the president and CEO of the logging company, the timber company, and about how he died. Talk about why he stayed where he did. What put him in harm's way?
Well, let's see. George Weyerhaeuser, the head of the Weyerhaeuser Company in 1980, is still alive today. He's in his late 80s. His son died later on. But, you know, the Weyerhaeuser Company underwent sort of transformation along with the rest of the economy. In 1980, it was still a family-owned, family-run public company. And loggers often worked for it for generations. It had a large, unionized employee roles. And after 1980, it began to change. The company became smaller. It started to shed a lot of our employees, its employees. A lot of the kinds of changes that have occurred since 1980 in the economy in general have occurred in Weyerhaeuser, too. At the time, in 1980, decisions were still sort of made close to the chest by George Weyerhaeuser, who was in charge of the company. He was the kind of guy who would ask other people for advice, but when it was time to make a decision, he made it and stuck by it. And that, too, had an influence on what happened that day in 1980. You know, one thing that's amazing about that eruption is that it occurred on a Sunday, right? It was a Sunday morning. As I point out in the book, when you go to southwestern Washington State, you run into many people who say, if that eruption had occurred on a weekday, I certainly wouldn't be here talking with you today. Probably hundreds of loggers in the surrounding woods would have been killed if the eruption had occurred on a weekday rather than a weekend.
Of course. All of the research that you did putting this book together, what most surprised you that you learned?
What most surprised me? You know, you said something very interesting in the intro, which is that history is present in the modern day. And I think that's what surprised me most. One of the reasons the danger zone was where it was is because of the land that George Weyerhaeuser's great-great-grandfather bought from his next-door neighbor in St. Paul. They had two mansions on Summit Avenue, and Frederick Weyerhaeuser bought all of these land grants from J.J. Hill, the builder of the Great Northern Railway, from St. Paul to Seattle. And that purchase, carried out in their living room, had these dramatic and, for many people, disastrous consequences 80 years later. So it's just an indication of how these historical forces play out in unexpected but powerful ways in the future, in the present, or in 1980 in the case that I write about in the book. And I think that's what most surprised me, is that when you dig deeper into these events, you start to see these deeper causes for things that happened.
Yeah, and prior to the explosion, the eruption, George was a pretty good boss. He paid his people well. He seemed to take care of his people. The people that were managing the loggers were very involved in the business. He was very hands-on. And then everything changed for them. And there's nobody in Weyerhaeuser. There's nobody in Weyerhaeuser Corporation now that is from the family. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, there's nobody on the board. It's no longer the family corporation that it was at the time. All publicly held corporations became much more concerned about the shareholder returns, the competition for Weyerhaeuser from the logging companies both in the southern United States and in Canada became much more intense. The company itself was undergoing a transformation because in 1980, they were cutting down the last of the old-growth trees that Frederick Weyerhaeuser had bought 80 years before. The company itself was about to make a major transformation away from harvesting virgin forest to harvesting forests that had been grown on just essentially gigantic tree farms. They were going to close down a lot of their mills that could mill the the 10-foot diameter trees that they were cutting down around Mount St. Helens and shift into being a different kind of logging company. And that's the company that they really are today.
I want to shift over to, I guess it's a question about experts on volcano. They're called volcanologists, right? Yeah. So Dave Johnston, he's a USGS scientist and expert on volcano gases. And I think I've read accounts before that these types of people put themselves so close to volcanic activity because they're so attracted to it, because they know so much about it, but they also know enough to stay away. Talk a little bit about when Dave Johnston, I think he was replacing someone in a helicopter to go and do an interview or something near, very near Mount St. Helens.
They do take risks, volcanologists, or at least historically they have taken risks. Dave Johnston was only 5 miles away from the peak of Mount St. Helens when it erupted. He was monitoring it that day. Yes, it was actually the first night he had spent at that observation post. He was filling in for a colleague who had to go to California to talk about a graduate program that he was taking, and he was quite nervous. Mm-hmm. He did not like the idea of being just 5 miles away from that volcano. He'd almost gotten in trouble with Mount Augustine, a volcano in Alaska, and had just barely escaped with his life. And however, he said, well, this volcano has been acting up for a couple of months, and I guess it can't, I'll go ahead and take the risk of just being 5 miles away for this one night, as long as someone comes in and spells me the next day. The geologists were aware that it was a risky spot. They had ordered basically an armored tank-like structure for them to get into if the volcano did erupt. And it was on its way to that observation post that Sunday morning when the volcano did erupt. The force of the eruption was so great, as you said in your introduction, that even if they were inside a tank, they would not have survived that eruption at that location.
Wow. Volcanic gases. How far away did those gases disrupt the lives of people in and around Mount St. Helens?
Oh, it is amazing when you think about it what happened is there was a large avalanche on Mount St. Helens, on the side of Mount St. Helens. The whole north side of the mountain essentially collapsed. And that released pressure that had been building up inside the volcano for the two previous months. The way geologists describe it is sort of like shaking a soda bottle and then taking the cap off. And this pressure just burst out of the side of the mountain to the north and the northwest. Coincidentally, and unfortunately, where the danger zones were the closest to the mountain. That blast knocked over this much of the remaining old-growth forest that Weyerhaeuser had. Trees 10 feet in diameter were just knocked over as if they were nothing.
Wow.
And the entire forest was completely wiped out. You might have seen pictures of the devastation after that. And that was the case even, I believe it was 17 miles on one side and 13 miles on the other side that this blast that emerged from the volcano was able to knock down these forests. Again, when you go there today, you just can't believe that anything would be that powerful. You know, what I wrote in the book is that Mount St. Helens was the most powerful natural disaster in history, that the eruption of that volcano on that day in 1980 had more energy than Hurricane Katrina or the 1906 earthquake in San Francisco. Of course, those events killed more people, but nothing was more powerful than the eruption of Mount St. Helens.
So, Steve, are you saying that a volcanologist is not a person that studies Vulcan life on Star Trek?
I think that's V-U-L, but...
I know, but, you know, anyway.
Could be.
You know, I'm curious. That geographic area is back in the news with the fault lines and people talking about what could happen if a big earthquake hit. How is that fault line or a series of fault lines connected to Mount St. Helens?
Oh, boy, you're absolutely right about that. I'm looking out the window of the 15th floor where I live here in Seattle, and it's all that anyone has been talking about for the past year. And that's a very productive conversation in Washington State for us to become more aware of the hazards that continue to exist up here, and not just volcanic hazards, but earthquake hazards as well. I was having this conversation with a geologist just last night. If there's a gigantic subduction zone earthquake in the Pacific Northwest, which would be the greatest natural disaster in in U.S. history. That would actually be more energetic than the eruption of Mount St. Helens, and it would kill more people than any other natural disaster in U.S. history. Would that have an effect on the surrounding volcanoes? Geologists are a bit uncertain about that. There is the possibility, the one I was talking to yesterday said, that that by jostling the Earth, it is the possibility that some of those volcanoes could become more active right after such an earthquake. But, you know, we're going to have our hands so full here in Seattle and Vancouver and Portland and all the surrounding areas if that earthquake, well, I shouldn't say if, when that earthquake occurs, that volcanic eruptions are probably going to seem like small potatoes comparatively.
So, Steve, if somebody goes out today and they want to build a home, there's all sorts of regulations that they have to adhere to make a solid home, knowing that it's close to a fault line. So is the real problem these legacy homes that were built, or these school systems that were built before they had hardened architecture?
That is a big problem here in Seattle. We have over 800 unreinforced masonry buildings. And in a subduction zone earthquake, many of those buildings, if not all of those buildings, including ones I'm looking at right now out my window, are going to just collapse in a heap of rubble. It is expensive to retrofit those homes, but it's something that needs to be done. The big earthquakes here in the Pacific Northwest happen every 500 years on average. The last one occurred in January of 1700, meaning that we're about 300 years after the last big earthquake here in the Pacific Northwest. But they can occur as little as 200 years after the previous earthquake, or as long as 700 years after the previous earthquake. It's really just like Mount St. Helens. You have to get as much information as you can about these hazards and then prepare accordingly. And yes, it is terribly inconvenient and it is expensive, but the alternative to taking those precautions when this disaster does occur, as it will, and our volcanoes are going to erupt again, is to suffer much greater consequences after the disaster than would be the case otherwise.
Right. Looking at some of the pictures that are included in your book, staggering photos. One, I think you sent along to us, just the plume of smoke and ash during the eruption. I'm curious about, you know, how these aerial photos were taken, and, you know, how quickly anyone taking the photos must have been overcome by ash. How quickly was this the spread of ash?
Well, you know, there's so many wild stories associated with the day of that eruption. But one wild story, one among many, is that two geologists were flying in a small Cessna over Mount St. Helens when it erupted. They were the only people up there at the time, but they had cameras. And, you know, the other amazing thing about Mount St. Helens is it occurred on a clear and sunny Sunday morning. I mean, goodness, we haven't seen the sun here in Seattle for 3 months, it seems like. So it was just the most amazing coincidence that people were able to take videos and photographs of it. There were lots of eyewitnesses around the volcano. The people in the Cessna escaped by putting the Cessna into a steep dive and getting away from the blast cloud. But the blast cloud almost got them. And then they turned around and looked back at the volcano, and they had their cameras, so they were taking photographs of it, and saw this immense column of ash rising at the ground into the air. People who've seen pictures of Mount St. Helens have seen pictures of that. But, you know, none of the photographs capture some aspects of that. For instance, those geologists said that the column of ash was just full of lightning, and the lightning was all different colors caused by the interaction of the light as it shone through the ash. Many people who survived the eruption and saw the blast cloud said it was just the most beautiful thing that they've ever seen. They've never seen anything like it. Will never see anything like it again. And you get some of that from the photographs that I've included in the book and other photographs that are available that survived from people who survived the eruption.
Yeah, 13 miles away, people died. What was the circumstance surrounding that?
Well, I think that the poor individual who was the farthest away was fishing with two friends on the Green River, even farther than 13 miles away. He might have been as much as 15 miles away. He was on the very edge of the blast cloud. So here's this blast cloud. It's coming from the volcano. I mean, they thought there's no possible way that the volcano could have an effect way out here. They couldn't even see the volcano from where they were fishing. All of a sudden, the forest around them is just falling in every direction. Two of the friends survived. Two of the friends were not hit by trees, but one one person who was fishing out there was not only hit by trees, but sort of swept away by the blast cloud. They never even found his body. He was both the farthest away from the volcano and one of a little less than half of the 57 victims who were never found again after the volcano erupted. That's how great the devastation was, even that far away from Mount St. Helens.
It's so interesting to go back. I don't know how old you were at the time of the eruption. I think you were away at college in the East, right?
Well, I was living in the East, but I was out of college. I was just about to get married. I was 3 weeks away from getting married to my wife, who was an Easterner, and we got married in Rhode Island. My grandmother, who lived in Othello, Washington, which is in eastern Washington, just downwind from the volcano, brought a jar of ash back to our wedding as a conversation starter. I oddly still have that jar of ash. When I do book talks, I put a little bit in a little shaker so that people can see what it looks like and smells and tastes like.
Somebody sent me a jar of ash.
I was not in this area. I moved back to Seattle about 6 years ago, and I said, well, I'd written previous books. I said, I want to write a book about the state where I grew up. And what's the most dramatic thing that's ever happened in this state? And it was clearly the eruption of Mount St. Helens.
Absolutely. Well, it is a wonderful book. It's Eruption, the Untold Story of Mount St. Helens. Steve Olson, thank you so much for joining us today on Cool Science Radio.
I've enjoyed it. Thanks.
And we'll be right back after these words. We're going from volcanic eruptions in the 1980 or eruption in 1980 to the digital age, where we are now.
This is Chris Robinson with Berkshire Hathaway Home Services, Utah Properties. KPCW is one of the many nonprofits our agents and companies support. They are the backbone of Summit and Wasatch counties in our incredible community. More info at bhhsutah.com.
Support for KPCW comes from the Park City Film Studios and Crandall Capital. Now open for business, the studio offers 3 sound stages, 45,000 square feet of meeting and event space, and dedicated truck and trailer parking, each with its own individual power hookups. Site plan, stage layout, and more at parkcityfilmstudios.com.
Hi, this is Angela from Peak Art and Frame, longtime supporters of KPCW. Peak Art and Frame offers custom picture framing, rush options, hanging and delivery services, and in-house designers. Open Monday through Saturday, located in the Walmart Shopping Center, 649-0801 or peakartandframe.com.
And welcome back to Cool Science Radio. We're just speaking with Steve Olson about the untold story of Mount St. Helens. The book is called Eruption, and now we switch to the digital age. And when protesters shattered the windows of a bus carrying Google employees to work, our next guest, Douglas Rushkoff, tells us their anger may have been justifiable, but it was misdirected. So who should it be directed at? Well, Dr. Rushkoff is about to tell us. He's going to tell us it's time to optimize our economy for the human beings it's supposed to be serving. Rushkoff will take us through his plan for how to combine the best of human nature with the best of modern technology. Dr. Rushkoff is an author, teacher, documentarian who focuses on the way people, cultures, and institutions create, share, and influence each other's values. He's written a new book called Throwing Rocks at the Google Bus, How Growth Became the Enemy of Prosperity. He joins us now by phone. Douglas Rushkoff, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
It's great to be with you.
Yeah, good to have you with us as well. So the title of your book is It Literally Happened. It's also figurative. Can you tell us a little bit about sort of the setup about how this actually happened literally with folks from Google starting to inhabit San Francisco from Silicon Valley and these special little buses that they have and what it did for the communities within San Francisco?
Well, you know, I guess most of us thought that the internet would bring great prosperity to places like San Francisco, where it all seemed to be happening. But what actually occurred was that a lot of people moved to the San Francisco region in order to work at Apple and Facebook and Google and Twitter and all those companies. But their presence really just raised the rents so incredibly high in San Francisco that the longtime residents had to leave, and longtime small family businesses were replaced by, you know, higher budget cafes and art studios and On the surface, it looked like San Francisco was getting wealthier, but the actual San Francisco, if you think of San Francisco as the people and businesses that were there, they were getting increasingly pushed out. And then Google, and it was a high-minded idea, they thought that rather than having tens of thousands of employees driving cars from San Francisco, where they wanted to live, down to Mountain View, the campus where the Google actually operates, rather than creating all that pollution and traffic, why don't they just supply people with free bus rides? You know, plus you can get an extra hour or two of work out of them as they sit on the bus going to Google and back. So they used public bus stops and picked up Google employees and started bringing them down to the campus and back. And it all looked good on paper, but then residents started to notice that rents near the Google bus stops were going up even 30% higher than they were already doubling everywhere else. So they kind of felt like the buses epitomized the way that digital companies, which originally seemed to promise all of this widespread prosperity, are actually extracting the value from people and places. So they lied in front of the buses and created, I think, a powerful protest. But it was so resonant for so many people that when a few other protests happened in Oakland, people started to throw rocks at the bus. And that's when I started to think, well, gosh, you know, the employees on the bus aren't necessarily the problem. So I really wanted to look at what was the systemic cause for all of this unrest.
I was going to say exactly the systemic cause of where that happened. And that, of course, played out when Walmarts were being put up 20 years ago around the country and people's frustration at these various things. You know, something fascinating in your book, there were, and that was about the currency of likes. And I remember somebody coming up to me and saying, hey, listen, I just bought this thing. And by the way, it had 1,800 reviews on Amazon, 4.5 out of 5 stars. And they're kind of saying, aren't I smart? I mean, isn't this really cool? Haven't I done the research? And then reading your book, and you talk about the currency of likes and how they have replaced the currency or how they sit alongside the currency of money. Can you talk about that a little?
Yeah, I mean, you bring up kind of two interrelated points here. I mean, one of them, the most interesting one for most people is that, you know, these companies don't have any more value they can extract from us. You know, people, and especially young people, we're getting poor. You know, we don't have any more money to give them. So they can't actually make revenue. These are not revenue-based operations. These are companies that are just really names on debt. They want to sell to another round of investors and move on. So if they don't have a metric of revenue, of actual earnings, that they could show future investors, they need a kind of a virtual metric, and that's likes. So if you have a product or a platform or a thing with lots of users, lots of likes, lots of retweets, that's your way of saying, look, I'm really popular, thus I deserve a lot of money. So you might have a game that has 2 or 3 or 100 million downloads. Even if you've given those downloads for free, that's a number that you can use to get acquired by Facebook or get acquired by Google. Mm. A company, you know, like Tumblr, was acquired for $1 billion, even though it showed no revenue. But that's because it had all sorts of likes and digital metrics that sort of substituted for real revenue.
Mm. Wasn't it just last week we heard the report about how Tumblr was so overvalued that it was such a mistake to purchase?
Yeah, well, it was certainly a mistake to purchase for $1 billion. But the problem is, the main problem here is that these companies are being configured in order to be purchased for a whole lot of money, mm-hmm. rather than being configured just to make revenue over the long term. So you look at a terrific application like Twitter. I think Twitter's a great app. It's 140 characters. They make $500 million a quarter in revenue. That's $500 million a quarter. And they are considered an abject failure by Wall Street, who want to make 100 times or 1,000 times their original investment in the company.
Hmm. when you talk about extracting value where there is none, it sounds very nefarious. I mean, it sounds like, you know, a pretty egregious trickery, really. Do you think it started off that way? I mean, I'd like to believe that innovation starts off with creativity and imagination, not necessarily with something that's going to extract these tiny pennies a billion times over and call it good.
Absolutely. I mean, most of the original developers of these applications and platforms were college kids when they came up with these ideas. You know, Google was invented in the dorm room of Stanford. You know, Apple was a product of two hippies, really, of two very optimistic young people. Twitter was intended as a very simple, light app, a way for people to do text messaging through the internet at no cost. But then what happens is these kids, really, they end up taking money from venture capitalists. Mm-hmm. And the venture capitalists aren't themselves evil, but they have a very specific goal, and that is to sell the company at 100 times what they put in within 18 to 24 months. So whatever that great idea was, whatever that company used to do, the value that that company created, that company needs to pivot, is what the technical term is. They pivot towards something that is much more scalable, that's much more huge, something that, even if it doesn't really do this, something that looks like it could essentially own the internet. So Twitter is supposed to pivot from a simple, beautiful, revenue-producing, extremely useful application. The presidential campaigns are happening on Twitter, for Christ's sake. So it's just a big, big thing. They must pivot to somehow, they're supposed to become the total communications platform for the internet. And that's really just not going to happen.
If you're just joining us, we're speaking with Dr. Douglas Rushkoff, who's written a fascinating book. I mean, this book really got me thinking. Throwing Rocks at the Google Bus, How Growth Became the Enemy of Prosperity. You know, everyone's talking about privacy today, and they're worried about their content. And you made a really good point that it's the metadata that's really important, or the metadata is what they're taking and that they're able to find out so much about us. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, most of us get concerned with, when we do get concerned with privacy, which probably isn't enough, we're more concerned that, oh, some company's going to read my email message, or they're going to know who I'm in love with, or what my sexuality is, or whether I smoke, you know, these secrets about me that I don't want coming out. And it's not your personal content that matters so much as the way big data analysis can figure things out about you that you might not even know. So it's not the specifics, it's what they can infer from the data. So they might see very innocuous stuff, like you make 3 phone calls every day from 10 to 11, you have 2 doors on your car, you looked at a cat advertisement today, and you bought sneakers within the last 6 months. For reasons that they don't even know or care about, that might put you in a category that is 80% likely to go on a diet in the next 2 weeks, or 80% likely to consider divorce in the next 2 weeks. So they know the likelihood of you doing things that you don't even know yet. So if Facebook or any of these information platforms knows that there's an 80% likelihood of you going on a diet in the next 2 weeks, all of a sudden your news feed will be filled with content that's about, maybe you're looking a little fat today. Are you healthy? How are you thinking about your food? Because what they want to do is not only make sure they sell their sponsors' products to the 80% of us in that category who are going to go on a diet, but to try to get that number up, to try to get it from 80% to 90%, because they know there's some likelihood of pushing those stragglers of us over the edge. And in the result of that is that these platforms are designed to reduce human autonomy, to make us more predictable, to make us behave truer to our consumer profiles. And that's not a liberating, empowering relationship to have with these technologies.
Yeah.
So they know that 80% are considering, or they're pretty confident that 80% are thinking about going on a diet. So what you're saying is that they target the other 20% who may or may not be, and they may send them messages that, hey, listen, you're fat, or, you know, you're not healthy or something, and they try to grab them in along with the 80. Is that what you're saying?
Exactly. They want to, the whole purpose is to increase human predictability. What happens when, it's funny, it sounds really evil or particularly new and evil, but it's what marketers have always done. Really, all we're really seeing now is that because digital companies need to make a whole lot of money much faster than is appropriate for any company, they're taking the scorched earth monopolistic practices of a Walmart and applying them in digital time and with digital power and scale. So instead of just Walmart, we see an Amazon or an Uber who can do this. They can really grow what took Walmart 50 years to do. They can do in 5 months. Much more impact all of a sudden.
One of the things that bothers Lynn and I are, for an example, we need a pair of snowshoes. So we look online, we find a pair of snowshoes, and maybe we buy it, maybe we don't. But then for the next 6 weeks, every time that we log on to some site, they're throwing snowshoes at us. And, they just seem to know everything, right?
Yeah, well, they will. They'll follow you. I mean, for sure. It is a little scary. You look at something one day and you come back and even on your email the next day, you start to see things on the side, pictures of the products that you looked at for one reason or another. And it's spooky. It's not just that, so they know I looked at a red New Balance shoe. It's just this feeling of being tracked, of being surveilled is itself unsettling or kind of off-putting. And the other thing you referred to before was the way that, your friend said, oh, look, I bought this thing because it had 4.5 stars and it was the highest rated one on Amazon. That also leads to some real economic effects. There's this quality of real winners and losers online, where we feel like everybody has more access to something like, say, music publishing. Anybody can write a song and record it in GarageBand and post it online in the iTunes store. And it seemed as if it would have this tremendously democratizing effect. The best internet theorists, people like Chris Anderson of Wired, wrote a book called Free and one called The Long Tail, where he was arguing that, look at how democratic this is going to be. We're all going to be rich forever. Yet what these recommendation engines do and these rating systems is they lead to these feedback loops where one or two things rise to the way top and everything else gets no sales at all, because there's leaderboards and top 10 lists. So, yes, that one song, that one device, that one thing ends up doing really, really well. But the great majority of producers end up off the map entirely.
Not to dwell on this subject, but I want to talk about how we are wising up to it a bit by way of giving you an example of something that happened to me last month visiting my son in college in Massachusetts, and I went through booking.com to book the hotel. Well, I did the trip. I booked it through that site, and my trip is done. So guess what? I'm not looking for hotels anymore. But guess what? Of course, predictably, I'm getting pop-ups every single day about hotels in Williamstown and great, great values. So I said to myself a couple weeks ago, I will never book through that site again. This is my commitment. I'll never book through them because, their algorithms aren't even good enough to know that I already booked. So I'm probably not going to do another vacation to Williamstown, the next week. Mm-hmm. So are we wising up? And is human intuition in some ways, beating the master algorithm?
It's interesting. I see it as my job is to fight for Team Human in this escalating arms race against our algorithm.
Yeah.
Right now, it seems to me like they're winning right now, in the short term anyway. I feel like most people, when they every time they touch their smartphone and move something in one direction or another or click on something, their phone is getting smarter about them as we get dumber about the phone. And that's why yeah. they're called smartphones. They are learning and we are not. And I applaud your intuition and growing resistance, this ability to say, you know, this doesn't feel right to me, and I'm not going to keep going. I'm going to find something else. For me, it was 4 or 5 years ago when I decided Facebook just feels so icky to me. I don't want to spend time on there. I don't want to encourage other people to spend time on there by maintaining a page and asking them for likes. And I don't want that. I just don't like that feeling. Something feels off. And of course, if you do all the research, you can see why it feels off. You understand that your update feed, your news feed is being configured by algorithms that are trying to get you to act in certain ways, that even on Google, your search results are different than someone else's. So I do think that we can educate ourselves. And the best way to do that, and it sounds so old-fashioned and hokey, but the best way to do that is to try to build up a wealth of experiences offline. Try to experience, especially for young people, look in other people's eyes, play with other people, put your smartphone away, talk to someone instead of texting them. The minute you really surrender your day to these interfaces, to these devices, instead of experiencing it in the real world, you lose your home field advantage. I feel it that humans do so much better when we have just a little bit of grounding in the real world. And young people in particular tend to accept these platforms and these applications at face value. They think that Facebook is really there to help them make friends, when we know that's not their purpose at all. The purpose of Facebook is to monetize a young person's social graph. It's to sell their consumer data to someone else, because the kids aren't paying. We are not the customers of these devices. We're the products. And in some cases, the unpaid labor force.
Well, all I can say is I wish it would happen to me what happened to you, where Facebook would start to feel yucky, kind of like I wish, you know, I was allergic to chocolate or something. I want to go back to something that you talked about right in the beginning, you know, tying into your title of the book, Throwing Rocks at the Google Bus. You talked about these great buses and how, you know, they're very luxurious from what I've heard. And really what it's also doing is getting another hour of work out of those employees riding the bus. And I wanted to ask you about the culture now in Silicon Valley. You know, you see these companies, these startups, so great to work for because the culture there is wonderful. They've got ping pong tables and you can eat anything you want all day long. And again, it's designed to get the 90-hour work week or whatever it is. And so speaking about extraction, you know, what's happening to these young, talented kids? Is this a good thing? Is it not? Is it the way that all companies should be treating their employees? Give them a great place to work. They'll want to stay.
Yeah, you would think. Everything that these companies do is optimized to extract value from someone or something. You know, these are not really technology companies so much as platforms designed to convert human labor and real places into share price. That's all they are. And once you understand them that way, once you look at them as engines in that way, as vacuum cleaners, then, well, as I did, you start to feel much more sorry for the people on the bus than jealous of them. These are kids who graduated Stanford or MIT or Harvard with great ideas about how they're going to save the world. And now they foolishly, I guess, took jobs at companies that they thought were the best, most progressive companies in the world. And they know now they've only got 3 or 4 years at the most until they burn out. That's what happens. That's how long a developer lasts before they're either fired or have to leave because they just can't do it anymore. And they go, they bring their laundry with them. They eat 3 meals there. They'll stay till midnight. And if they don't, then they're not going to have as good output as anybody else. Even Google at the beginning said, oh, employees can spend one day a week or 20% of their time doing their own projects. Well, that's gone. That sort of policy doesn't fly anymore. Even Google itself is gone. Google has become a new company. It's called Alphabet. And Alphabet is not a technology company. Alphabet is a holding company. So what they do now, rather than innovating themselves, is they buy and sell other technology companies.
Yeah. Douglas, unfortunately, we're running out of time. We very much enjoyed this conversation. I just want to ask a final question on human behavior. You have a section in your book talking about the stock market, and we know about market makers, and we've all heard about these sophisticated algorithms where they flood quote and order systems to fake these trades to try to move the market in a certain direction, or algorithms that run on super fast computers to get a leg up of several milliseconds so that they can, the system's rigged. We all know that. But why are we all still in the market? I'm still in the market, and I know this stuff. I'm ready to start throwing rocks, I think, if I can find a bus. But why are we still in the market?
Well, I think a lot of us are still in the market because what else are you going to do? You know, if you can't beat them, join them. I think that we're assuming that somehow capitalism always wins, so you've got to place some bet on that. You know, I'm suggesting that people diversify in a more profound way, not diversify in terms of having 10 different kinds of stock, but having 10 different kinds of investment. Invest locally, invest in yourself, invest in local businesses, invest in community-supported agriculture. Look at how you can invest in ways that optimize for the circulation of currency, for the amount of transactions in your own community. Try to multiply transaction and create currents rather than taking money off the playing board, out of the economy, and throwing it into some S&P fund, which isn't even real anymore. It's hard. You know, the other thing is these interfaces that we use, whether you're going on E-Trade or CharlesSchwab.com, they're all designed to give us a feeling of mastery, to make us feel like we have more control and more information. And as every behavioral finance expert will tell you, the way to get people to make lots and lots of trades is to give them the experience, the illusion of mastery and authority over information.
Yeah, boy. Well, good end to a good conversation. We want to thank you again for joining us. Douglas Rushkoff, who has written a book, Throwing Rocks at the Google Bus, How Growth Became the Enemy of Prosperity. I hope you join us again.
Well, thank you. Thanks for doing some smart radio. It's great to talk to you.
Oh, thank you very much.
Thanks, Douglas. And you've been listening to Cool Science Radio. We'll be right back.
This is Earl Foote, founder of Nexus IT, a proud sponsor of Cool Science Radio on KPCW. Nexus IT provides comprehensive cybersecurity solutions to help protect your business from hackers and today's internet-borne security threats. More information at nexusitc.net or at 435-487-9099.
Additional funding for programming on KPCW has been provided in part by Long Reimer Weiniger Bepler, Estate Planning, Family Law, LRW-Law.com, and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and listeners like you.
Thanks for tuning in to Cool Science Radio. You've been listening to KPCW Park City. Want to thank our underwriters, San Francisco Design, Berkshire Hathaway Home Services, Utah Properties, Peak Art and Frame, Nexus IT, the Natural History Museum of Utah, and Park City Mountain Resort. Also want to thank our guest today, Douglas Rushkoff, Throwing Rocks at the Google Bus, and Steve Olson, the author of the book Eruption, The Untold Story of Mount St. Helens. It's time now to head into National Public Radio News from Washington.